Well, welcome to lesson number 10 on Ericksonian hypnotherapy. I'm Dr. Richard Dongard, and I'm going to discuss the process of Ericksonian hypnotherapy today. It may seem strange to actually wait until lesson 10 for the for a description of the process of Ericksonian hypnotherapy, but in some ways it's very Ericksonian to do that. Like I said, when I first did training with Bob Boulay in Germany, he just began with an arm levitation with zero explanation. The process in Ericksonian hypnotherapy is much less dependent on a specific order or specific tasks being carried through. The idea of Ericksonian hypnotherapy really is predicated on what it is that our client needs. So far in this course, it might actually appear that I've taught it out of order with no beginning and no end. There's actually an old joke. Did you hear about the Ericksonian stage hypnotist? You never know when the show began or when the show ended. Here's actually how Milton Erickson worked. And the way he worked is actually different than the way that we work. His time was different. His role was different. His clients were different. Erickson worked out of his house. This was in large part due to his physical limitations, especially in his later life when he was confined to the wheelchair long before the American with Disabilities Act existed. So as a result of this, people were brought to his house, and people who were brought to his house knew that they were seeing somebody special, and they also knew that this special person was a medical doctor. He wasn't representing himself as a hypnotist, although he was a hypnotist. He was representing himself as a psychiatrist. That brings about an entirely different perception from the client to the hypnotist than it does in the majority of the cases for those listening to this. He frequently, during his sessions, had observers and medical students present. He was probably, above all else, a teacher, and his home was open not only to those who needed his help, but to those who wanted to learn his methods. He spoke to his clients in conversation. He believed that the challenge was not, how do I go about hypnotizing them, but rather, how do I go about using the naturally occurring trance states? How do I utilize this? How do I direct this? I think a lot of hypnotists wonder, how do I get the person hypnotized? Milton Erickson didn't wonder that. He believed that really we had multiple trance states that always existed at various times, and that the real challenge for him was how to utilize these trance states. As a result, for some clients, he had a formal induction. Close your eyes. Now you're going deep into hypnosis. But for others, they found themselves in deep trance simply through his conversation with him, using the language patterns and the ideas. Now, I am, of course, a licensed marriage and family therapist. I'm providing psychotherapy in a variety of settings, not only as a clinical hypnotist, but in inpatient psychiatric treatment as well as outpatient therapy. I do a lot of training for other licensed mental health professionals, and it's always amazing to me how many of them are really excited to come to my training to learn how to do hypnosis. But they've been a social worker or a marriage and family therapist or a professional counselor for 10 or 15 or 20 years. And it's always interesting to me that they are excited about learning hypnosis, because if they're a halfway decent therapist, they've been doing hypnosis for the last 10, 15, or 20 years. They just didn't know it. In fact, most of the therapists who come to my class discover that they've already been doing hypnotherapy. They just didn't know how to structure it or to utilize those trance states. Because when a client comes into the therapist's office, and therapists usually have their office in an informal sort of living room-ish sort of comfortable setup, and set aside the problems of the day and have a focused conversation with a person, that person might identify as being a cognitive behavioral therapist, or might identify as having a psychodynamic approach, or might identify as a contextual psychologist, but the reality is those are in fact hypnotic processes. So when Milton Erickson spoke to people in conversation in therapy, even if there wasn't a formal induction, people found themselves in deep trance, just like they do in every therapist's office. This is why the pre-talk is not something that we try to get through to get to the good part of hypnosis. Pre-talk is conversational hypnosis. It is a hypnotic process. Erickson also used many nonverbal strategies to induce trance. His tone of voice, his pitch, whether or not he touched them or not, and how he leaned in. Milton Erickson's main goal was to make a person feel welcome and at ease. That was really his primary goal. I, of course, never had the chance to meet Milton Erickson. He died, I think, about the same time that I was entering high school, and I wish that I had had that opportunity. But it's very apparent for me that he had concern for his patients' well-being. He genuinely enjoyed being a physician and helping people to heal, just like he had used these same techniques in self-hypnosis to heal from his polio. His main goal was not to hypnotize a person. It was to make them feel welcome and at ease, to develop rapport, which equals engagement. And engagement always results in trance. People spent a lot of money to learn the secrets of Milton Erickson, how to hypnotize people covertly without their knowledge. All you have to do is engage people. When we have rapport and engagement, we always have trance. Sometimes Milton Erickson did what looked like a formal process of hypnosis, induction, deepener, suggestive therapy, awakening. Other times his processes look much less structured. One of my favorite things to do is simply to read his case studies. He wrote many of his case studies in great detail, paying attention to the dialogue between him and the clients. And it's really a great way to see how Milton Erickson conducted these sessions. His goal was never to achieve a specific state. He was not using, for example, the Harry Arons depth rule. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Harry Arons, but in the 1940s, he wrote a book on hypnosis. It was a very popular book, and he actually had a ruler in it with the inches marked off at what various levels of trance depth were, corresponding to the related hypnotic phenomena. And Harry Arons believed that in certain states we experienced certain trance states result in certain phenomenological outcomes. That wasn't what Milton Erickson believed. He wasn't ever trying to achieve a specific state. Rather, his goal was to discover what in the internal resources of the client was going to be most beneficial to them. For some clients, they were in deep trance. Others, they were in light trance. Others in, if such a thing is possible, no trance at all. Now, that's how Milton Erickson structured his sessions. I thought I would share with you how I structure my sessions. Then I'm going to share with you how Bill O'Hanlon, who wrote a book called A Guide to Trance Land, perceived Ericksonian hypnosis and the structure of Ericksonian hypnosis fitting into a solution-oriented approach. So how do I structure my sessions? My clients call me for hypnosis, and they have a perception, probably based on Hollywood, of what this is going to be. Now, I don't mean a Hollywood perception because they watch Dracula movies, look deep into my eye, deep into my eye, the old Bela Lugosi character. But, you know, they've seen Hollywood movies where somebody goes to see a hypnotist, like Office Space or something like that, and, they expect a professional office. They expect me to look like an accountant or a lawyer or any other professional. And they also expect that at some point I'm going to have them close their eyes, they're going to relax in a recliner, and that I'm probably going to count backwards from 10 and that they're going to, quote unquote, go into trance. This is really different than the way Milton Erickson's clients presented. They didn't know what to expect and they were seeing a medical doctor. My clients are making an appointment with a hypnotist and they have a perception of what that's going to be. So I have an entirely different frame than Milton Erickson did. This is really important. Because my clients have a perception about what they're going to be buying from me, a hypnosis session, I do tend to do formal trance processes with every one of my clients. This does not mean that I don't do conversational and formal hypnosis. In fact, I do quite a bit of it. But it's my belief that by the time my client gets to the recliner and closes their eyes, that all we're engaged in now ideally is a ritual to ratify the change which has already taken place. I meet my clients at my desk and I conduct an interview with them. This is where hypnosis begins, and often actually begins on the phone with them. Some people might call this a pre-talk, but I really view it as my chance to create rapport and change before any formal process. some examples specifically of how to do that with my clients. All of I have a basket in my office, and it's filled up with cigarettes, lighters, cans of Copenhagen, Skoal, etc. And those are all cigarettes and tobacco products that my clients have turned in, if you will. And so I ask all of my clients a simple question during my pre-talk after I do the paperwork, and that question is, have you had your last cigarette? And some of them say, well, yes, I did. Before I came in, I smoked my last cigarette, or last night I smoked my last cigarette. That's my favorite response. Those folks always do well. Sometimes they look at me with panic and say, I'm not sure. And I ask them then, do you have cigarettes in your purse or in your car or in your pocket? And they almost always say yes. And I'll say to them, well, then you haven't had your last cigarette. And so then I give them the instruction to go outside, out to their car, to get their cigarettes, to get their lighters, the other accoutrements of smoking. And I tell them have their last cigarette if they would like to, and then to bring all of that in. When they come in, sitting on my desk is this basket. I don't have to tell them what to do. It's sitting there. They immediately come in with their cigarettes, their lighters. They put that in the basket. I take the basket, I pick it up, and I put it on the bookshelf behind my desk. I haven't said anything here during this process. Obviously, the suggestion is you are now no longer a smoker. That's a very powerful place for my clients to be. And it's before they ever sit in the chair and close their eyes. So now when they sit in the chair, I can say to them, as you sit in this chair as a non-smoker, because in the present, at that moment, they are a non-smoker, and I address them as a non-smoker from that point forward. Another way I do accomplish hypnosis in my pre-talk before any formal process is I will often teach them a basic strategy in mindfulness meditation. I will say to my client, before we go over to the hypnotic furniture, I want to share with you a process. This is going to be your homework assignment, and it's an exercise to help you focus on the present moment through mindfulness. And I'll take them through a 2-minute process of mindfulness meditation before I ever get to the hypnotic furniture. Well, now I have a state, a resource state that they've already achieved. I've essentially pre-hypnotized them, if you want to call it that. And I can anchor it during my session with them. Before I ever get to the hypnotic furniture, I have already given a pedometer to my weight loss clients. Actually, in 2013, that's a little bit different. I used to give a pedometer to all of my clients. Now I actually help them download the app onto their smartphone. But I do have a few clients who don't have a smartphone, and I do have a few pedometers left that I give out. I always do move my clients from the front desk to the hypnotic furniture. My clients do use headphones. I do use background music. So I'm engaged in really a more formal process than Milton Erickson. But at the same time, the foundation of his techniques are present. And what I want you to see as I describe these vast differences between my work and Milton Erickson's work is that you can really structure hypnosis using Ericksonian techniques in a number of different ways. I do formal induction, but I almost always start with my client's primary representational system. If they are auditory, I use auditory suggestion. If they're kinesthetic, I use kinesthetic suggestion. If they're visual, I use visual suggestion. Now, I don't do this in every session, but in my first session, I try to be very consistent with their primary representational system. In successive sessions, I might decide they need to learn another way of learning things. So I will actually teach them kinesthetic inductions when they're not very kinesthetic. But I believe that induction teaches a skill. It's as valuable as any other process. So the induction is not something I rush through or try to get over. I came out in 2006 with the Speed Trance DVD series with John Cerbone. I'm an expert in rapid induction. Some of you have seen my videos of stage hypnosis on the Las Vegas Strip when I used to perform stage hypnosis and when I used to perform stage hypnosis on the Las Vegas Strip. I don't believe the induction is something to get through to get to the good stuff, though. In clinical hypnosis, the induction is the good stuff. I usually do a deepener, but one that I can use again is a transitional deepener, and I tend to like the number count. The reason why is my clients have seen it on TV. They expect that a hypnotist counts backwards. And when I start counting backwards, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. What happens is my client's subconscious mind says, oh my gosh, hypnotists do really count backwards. I saw this on TV. And so the subconscious mind says, he's counting backwards. I must be going into trance. And they do. I do storytelling, parable, and metaphor, and indirect suggestion, usually after my deepener. Then during my suggestive therapy, I teach and practice mindfulness skills, the ideas of contextual psychology. I do that with every one of my clients. These are not incompatible with Ericksonian hypnotherapy. They can be utilized with Ericksonian hypnotherapy. One of the things I think we need to recognize, you know, I meet people who, you know, Dave Ellman was her favorite hypnotist, or Milton Erickson was, or, you know, whoever else was her favorite hypnotist, and yet they're still practicing the same methods of 1950 or 1930 or, you know, 1820. And the reality is we can use the knowledge, the body of knowledge that these people gave to us, but we can build on it and use modern methods in conjunction with this. In my practice, I always focus on creating resource states and giving my clients ownership of that. I use this line almost all the time with my clients. This is not a state which I've created, but rather one that you've created here in my office by simply following this process. As a result, this is a state that you own, that you can actually take with you when you leave here today, that you can access at any time in any place that you need to use. The state of relaxation, learning, confidence, whatever the resource state is. I use anchoring to create anchors to these states, and we'll talk about anchoring in one of our upcoming sessions. I use direct suggestion. Milton Erickson did too. He just cloaked it in indirect language. And post-hypnotic suggestions. I do an awakening, a reorientation, and I usually evaluate this process in context of time distortion with my clients. All of these steps that I utilize in my basic process of hypnosis are predicated on a foundation of Ericksonian language patterns and really the Rogerian unconditional positive regard for the person who's come into my office. Bill O'Hanlon has written a great little book called A Guide to Trance Land. It's a practical handbook of Ericksonian and solution-oriented hypnosis. I really like solution-oriented approaches, solution-oriented brief therapy. I think they are easily integrated with Ericksonian approaches and contextual approaches to hypnotherapy. And Bill O'Hanlon gives really a one-page description of the process of Ericksonian hypnotherapy and context of solution-oriented treatment. And so in this lesson, what I've done is I've shared Milton Erickson's structure, and I shared my structure. Here's how Bill O'Hanlon views the structure of Ericksonian hypnosis. What this means is that you can create your own structure. You can take what's useful and helpful to you and apply it within the context of your own personality and your own treatment setting and the type of clients that you work with. O'Hanlon outlines these 11 things. Number one, assess the complaint and identify the goals. Through conversational hypnosis, seed change and create expectancy for change. By the way, learning the expectancy techniques of Dave Ellman can be real helpful in this phase of O'Hanlon's model. Even though I don't do the Dave Ellman induction, Dave Ellman's ideas of expectancy really were brilliant. Two, determine that the complaint is an automatic process or a subconscious process. If not, if it's a biological process or some other unknown process, we probably want to pursue non-hypnotic interventions. In this case, for most of us, it would mean a referral to for somebody, to a physician or, you know, other caregiver. Then in our discussion with them, introduce the notion of inner work and hypnosis, how this is an internal dialogue. Reassure and reframe, and what we're reassuring and reframing is that this is their time, their process, and that they have the ability within them to experience success. I'm not going to be doing anything to them. I'm going to be doing something with them during the session. That's a real important reframe for a lot of clients. They come in, they have seen Hollywood, and they think because I'm a hypnotist, I'm going to do something to them. And really what I want to do is do something with them. Step number four in O'Hanlon's process, introduce the inner focus, evoke resources, that sensorial related language, get responses, the language patterns of Milton Erickson, help the person rearrange his or her experiential reality, offer a series of possibilities, choices that our clients can make, faked alternatives in many cases, and notice which one the person responds to. This implies, again, that we're talking to our client during therapy. Link the evoked resources and alterations to the future and to an appropriate context for manifesting those solutions and resources. Complete the inner work or hypnosis if we're using a formal process. And then O'Hanlon recommends that we discuss the experience with the client as little or as much as the person wants to. My clients often like talking about their hypnosis sessions, and so I do. I normalize or reassure things if needed. Sometimes my clients say, well, I'm not sure that was helpful because I could hear every word, and I recognize that I must have missed something during my pre-talk, or that they missed something, and I'll reassure them that it's perfectly okay by being able to pay attention to every word that I used. They did the right thing, and usually that is really helpful to them. Continue seeding change and creating expectancies for change. That means with conversational language and suggestions. At the next contact, gather as much information about or on the post-session response and results and utilize those things that worked for them. Number 9, induce the inner state. Continue or expand the responses that helped. Offer new possibilities if necessary. And then repeat steps 7 to 9 as often as necessary until you and the client are certain you're complete with the work. I usually see my clients typically for about 3 sessions. And of course, at the end of a session, arrange for follow-up through scheduled visits. Well, Hanlon mentions postcards, letters, phone calls, and so on. Let me just talk about that for a moment. I do not contact my clients after they leave my office unless they have a desire to contact me. I know that this is different than what other people do. You can do it any way you want to. I consider myself a resource for my clients. I am here for my clients. I'm available for my clients. If my clients would like to follow up with me, I am more than happy to have them do so. If they choose not to follow up with me, I am perfectly okay with that as well. It is their life. I am their resource. I am not their mother. I'm going to share with you an MP3 that I'm going to splice into this MP3 from my friend and colleague Dave Perk. It's a great Ericksonian hypnosis session, so you can see how unstructured the structure of Ericksonian hypnosis can actually be from another instructor as well as me during this course. There are 2 exercises from this lesson, though, before I share with you Dave Perk's Prairie Dog MP3. And the exercises, the homework assignment, if you will, are really 2 things. 1, think of how you can integrate the Ericksonian techniques you've learned into the structure that you provide in your setting. I shared Bill O'Hanlon's model, my observation of Milton's model from his writings. Look, if we're on lesson 10, I've gotten to such a personal level with him that I'm calling him Milton now. So future pace yourself and see yourself incorporating these ideas into your own work. And then exercise number 2. If you're driving, you're probably going to want to skip this section because I'm going to play one of Dave Park's MP3 hypnosis sessions for you. But at some other point, in addition to now, listen to Prairie Dogs again. Make it a part of your self-hypnosis or meditation process. It really is awesome. And before I splice in Prairie Dogs, let me explain to you where this came from. A couple of years ago, about 3 years ago, I actually had a couple of TIAs, mini strokes, and ended up in the hospital. Not being one who really is a fan of traditional medical treatment, I was kind of freaked out, as you would expect, in the hospital. And so I called Dave in the middle of the night, and I said, Dave, you got to help me. Look, here's what happened. I'm stuck in this hospital. I'm in telemetry. There's all kinds of heart monitors and all kinds of things tied up to me. I don't know if I'm going to live or die or what's going on here, but I need you to hypnotize me. And so Dave said, well, give me 20 or 30 minutes. And I said, okay. And so 20 or 30 minutes, he called me back. And he said, I sent you an MP3. He said, this is for you. And so I'm going to share that with you because it was something he put together in a very short period of time, and it's absolutely brilliant. But it really follows the Ericksonian model and language pattern and story and metaphor. It does not have a formal induction, and yet you'll find it mesmerizing and induces deep trance. If you're looking for more resources from Dave Park, you can find Dave at www.lifeafterfear.com. And Dave Park and I frequently teach classes together. He's a certified professional hypnotist. He's a certified life coach, certified through the Center for Credentialing and Education, and lives in New York City. And without further ado, here's Prairie Dogs from Dave Park, which he made for me.
You may already know that I grew up in Kansas. Kansas is an interesting state with wide open plains and clear, endless skies. When I was a boy in Kansas, I always enjoyed the springtime. The springtime for me is a very, very relaxed time now. Springtime is a time of natural growth and healing. And during the spring, I would easily walk to my favorite park near my house, where I would always find my friends waiting for me. We would sprawl out in the green plush grass and talk for hours about the things boys talk about. We would talk about sports or television or the new girl in school. And I'm sure you know the feeling as you lay on the grass, looking up at a clear blue sky, getting carried away in important conversations about nothing. You know you don't have a care in the world in this moment, and this moment lasts forever. And as we talk, I look up at the sky, at the clouds. Occasionally I would see shapes in the clouds. I might see a puppy, or a kitten, or a little squirrel. And when I would think about squirrels, I would think about prairie dogs. Because prairie dogs, after all, are a type of squirrel. And sometimes I would wonder why squirrels were called prairie dogs, or why a squirrel was called a dog, because I didn't know of any dogs that were called squirrels. And prairie dogs actually live in their own towns. And I don't know if their towns have names, but I do know that they are a complex system of passages and veins. And the heart of the prairie dog family is made up of several chambers. Those chambers are connected to the body of the prairie dog community by a system of tunnels. And those tunnels help the prairie dogs get around, and they also help with moving rainwater throughout the community and controlling erosion inside the body of the prairie dog community. Of course, sometimes the erosion is a little too much for the tunnels to handle, and it collects on the side of the tunnels. Luckily, the community of prairie dogs are skilled at handling these problems and have the natural and organic ability to clear these blocked passages quickly and easily. And all it takes for the community is to work together in an instinctive and natural way And everything in nature is like that, isn't it? Wherever there is a problem, nature has given us the biological solution. All we have to do is allow our natural defenses and our natural diggers to do their jobs. Just like the prairie dogs that I would sometimes see in those easy, fluffy clouds as they are drifting by on a spring day. And then our conversations might turn to the changing of the seasons. And Kansas was a place of hot summers and cold winters, and cold winters and hot summers. And the winters, which were cold and brisk, with plenty of snow. I always enjoyed the winter, and I always enjoyed the snow, because most young boys do enjoy the snow, and we enjoy making forts and building snowmen and having snowball fights. But there was another interesting thing that I learned about the winters in Kansas and the way things work. The roads in Kansas are flat and smooth, and it is very easy for the traffic to move on these roads, very natural for it to flow back and forth. And you can imagine the traffic on an easy day just flowing through the network of highways and roads. And during the winter, as it snows in Kansas, sometimes the snow builds up on the roads. But the cities are already prepared for that and have created an organic way to remove the collection of the snow. The city may put salt down on the roads, which is a way to prevent the snow from sticking and from collecting, so traffic continues to move easily. But sometimes the snow does stick, and one of the smaller veins of roadwork will become a little blocked or impeded by the snow. The city has an organic defense against this, too. It will activate its snow plows and snow trucks to go out and easily remove the blocked snow, the built-up snow. And I learned that the snow removal was a natural part of the city's planning, that the city had learned long, long ago, many, many generations ago, how to take care of itself and how to remedy the problems that it may have, such as the buildup of snow on the roads. And sometimes, instead of thinking about winter, I would think about the summer. And the summers were a fun time for us, and they still are. But my friends and I, we always enjoyed going to our favorite water park. And the water park had a number of different features, each one appealing to each of us. And some of my friends really enjoyed the water slides, the idea of moving quickly and easily down a smooth surface rushing from one point to the next, easily and without hesitation. I actually preferred the wave pool. I like the far end of the wave pool the best. It is quiet and relaxed. And I would lay on my raft and listen to the happy sounds of people enjoying themselves far off in the distance. Not so loud, but more like the happy chatter of birds. They were gleeful and healthy children. Children like you and me. And on the far end of the wave pool, where I like to be, is where the waves first start. So all that is felt is a gentle and slow rocking motion as I lay upon the raft. And it's that rocking motion, the drifting and dreaming, that, as you know, carries you deeper and deeper. And sometimes, as you are being carried gently, floating, I would count. Sometimes I would count as the waves would rock, and I would tell myself, you will go deeper with each wave as it gently rolls. And the first wave would roll under me, and I would quietly think, 10. And the second wave would follow the first, and I would think, 9. And then one by one, the waves would gently and easily follow, 8, 7, and now 6. And a warm breeze, carrying away all thoughts and leaving a wonderful, pleasant sensation, would blow across your body. 5, floating, drifting, and dreaming. 4, 3, the warm sun bathing you in a healthy, healing light, enabling your natural healing ability to do what is so easy for it to do. 2, no cares in the world, completely relaxed. And 1, nothing but bliss and joy and deep, deep relaxation. And just thinking about those days as I lay on the grass on a beautiful spring day, watching as the clouds float across an open sky, I realize that you can learn so much in those quiet moments. And a lot of the learning comes with just listening and allowing. And right now you can listen and allow for as long as you like, lying here in the grass on a beautiful spring day. You may drift off into a deep, healing sleep, or if you choose, you may gently emerge from this while allowing your body to resume its natural healing process. And you can take all of the time that you want. To do whichever you choose. Drifting and floating. Dreaming. Allowing yourself and allowing your body to listen, to heal, restoring yourself to a vibrant, healthy state.